Good morning, and thanks for tuning in to Behind the Headlines, the weekly news recap from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard statewide on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today, the legislative replacement of voter-approved Medicaid expansion in Utah advances, despite a no vote from its House sponsor. Also, there were historic changes in San Juan County this past election, and now freshman Representative Phil Lyman says it might be time for a portion of that county to split away. And lawmakers say it's time to get rid of the Utah Constitution's slavery ban exemption. Joining me for this conversation, we've got Salt Lake Tribune government and politics editor Dan Harry. And welcome, Dan. Good morning.
Good morning, Roger.
Reporter Bethany Rogers is here. And thanks for being here as well, Bethany.
Thanks for having me.
And columnist Holly Richardson. Thanks for being on, Holly.
Yeah, thanks.
Good morning. Listeners, you are invited to join this conversation with your questions and comments. Call us at 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. Or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page that's currently live at sltrib.com. We will start this week once again with the legislation that would replace the voter-passed Medicaid expansion that came from Proposition 3. And Dan Harry, SB 96, this is now on to its final vote before going to the governor for a signature, assuming nothing happens in the House, right?
Well, yeah, I count the governor as the final vote.
Okay.
But yeah, it's headed to its final vote in the legislature.
Something somewhat unusual for any bill to happen happened this week, and that was that the House sponsor of this bill in a committee vote voted no on it. Why did he do that?
Well, that's an interesting question. You're talking about Representative Jim Dunnigan, who happens to be my legislator from Taylorsville. And he conducted the committee through which the bill passed. He is the House sponsor. He voted against it and then immediately fist bumped Senator Alan Christensen, who is the original sponsor of the bill. And he wouldn't answer questions from reporters about why he voted against it. We do know that voters in his district passed the Medicaid expansion initiative, and so you've got to think that has something to do with it. He has said in a previous interview with the Tribune that he was well aware that the voters in his district had passed it. So you got to think that that's had an effect on it. But I don't know why he wouldn't comment about it. It's a little strange.
Well, right? Not to read too much into it, but the fist bump is also interesting. I mean, that just seems sort of bizarre. I vote against your proposal, and now let's fist bump. Can we read anything into it? Maybe that's just reading tea leaves. I don't know, Dan.
I can't read that either. I'm not quite sure about that.
Dunnigan in this committee also made a motion to do away with language in SB 96, this Medicaid expansion replacement proposal. That would repeal all Medicaid expansion in Utah if the federal waivers that are required for it to happen are denied. We need waivers because we're not doing what's laid out under the Affordable Care Act for Medicaid expansion. Though that would happen under Prop 3, we would fit the bill under Proposition 3. But can you tell us about the provision that would repeal Medicaid expansion that Dunnigan floated?
Okay, so what Republicans are saying, the whole reason that they're trying to change it is they fear that it's going to be a budget buster. And so they're trying to put safeguards in it that they say will protect the state from, you know, possible runaway costs that run into the tens of millions or even hundreds of millions down the road. And so one of the provisions they had was that if they don't get federal permission to do these other things outside of the Affordable Care Act, like work requirements and not covering people up to 138% of poverty, they only want to go up to 100% of poverty, that if they don't get federal permission to do that, they would simply wipe out the whole program. And, you know, that obviously alarmed advocates who see that as, you know, not advancing the health care coverage of Utahns, but actually going backward on it. So, yeah, they stripped that out in the House committee after the Senate had passed it. And now they're negotiating about a different kind of fallback position if they don't get these federal waivers. There's talk about just having it fall back to basically Proposition 3 that it would cover folks up to 138% of poverty.
Right. This is maybe a different bill that's being discussed, at least up on the Hill, is a bill that would allow that to happen, for us to just revert to Prop 3, which was passed by voters, if those waivers don't come through.
Well, I think what will happen is, this is just me speculating, but I think what will happen is they'll use SB 96 as the vehicle for that. Mm-hmm. You know, it's already passed the House, passed the Senate. It's passed committees in both houses. So a lot of times they'll just substitute whatever they want to in a bill that's mm-hmm. that's already out there.
So there's a kind of gamble. Well, not gamble, but conceivably you could have, if proponents of full Medicaid expansion in Utah really believe that that this SB 96 can't get those waivers, which is something that they've been arguing, they might want to see it passed and then see the federal government turn down our request for waivers, so that we can have Proposition 3. Of course, that delays the whole process of Medicaid expansion in Utah.
Yeah. The waivers is an interesting proposition, because we've had experience with this. We've applied for some of these waivers. We've never got approval of them. But now Senator Christensen and Representative Dunnigan are saying they have privately received assurances that we're going to get this. So basically what they're saying is, trust me. Hmm. And that's kind of what the whole Republican majority in the legislature is doing, because all of these deliberations are going on behind closed doors.
There's this quote at the end of the Tribune article on all of this from Greg Hartley, who's the chief of staff to House Speaker Brad Wilson, and he says that SB 96 provides coverage options to the same amount of people as Proposition 3 would, with an enrollment date that mirrors the proposition. Coverage options, aren't there 50,000 fewer people who will be covered under Medicaid expansion?
Under Medicaid, okay. Yeah. So what they're saying is those people would be eligible to get insurance under the Affordable Care Act.
Meaning those people who aren't covered, and that could be as many as 50,000 people, could go out and buy insurance, subsidized insurance, but to mm-hmm. go out and buy it. I want to bring Holly Richardson in on this, a columnist from the Salt Lake Tribune. How closely, Holly, have you been following this debate, and what do you think about how things have gone since the passage of Proposition 3 in November?
Well, I'll make all my Republican friends mad at me, but I think they have really stunk it up, especially with as Dan pointed out, the behind-the-scenes negotiations that are not being done in the public eye. I think the speed at which they are slamming this through, I mean, this is something that you usually see at the very end of the session, not the very beginning. Mm. I think their messaging is terrible. I think it comes across as incredibly condescending. Well, if you only knew how to read a bill, you wouldn't have voted for this proposition, right? And I think it's I tangled with on Twitter with a couple of legislators, including Dan McKay, who then privately is like, hello, what did I do? Forget to send you a Christmas card? I'm like, no, but you can't be so dismissive of your constituents and the people in the state who say this is something that we voted for and something that we want, and then say, well, you don't know like I know, right?
I mean, this has been an argument, is that you don't know what you voted for.
I know. And I think it's incredibly condescending, right? So A, I think the messaging is terrible. I think if they're quote, truly concerned about the budget busting. And I think there probably is really genuine concern about that. But I think if that's the case, that they really, really need to step back, look at the speed, look at how this is coming across, because I think it's just, the responses I've seen from members of the public, both on social media and elsewhere, is that they feel completely dismissed, completely condescended to, and it's like, well, what's the purpose of having a citizens initiative if all you're going to do is overturn it?
I think that's the most amazing part of this story is we've seen in the past, we had a referendum in 2007 where voters rejected school vouchers, which was passed by the legislature. The legislature has not touched vouchers since then. They recognized, look, the voters have spoken. We don't dare tinker with this. All of a sudden, those floodgates are open, and all of these initiatives that have passed, we've seen the medical marijuana one changed. Mm-hmm. There was a negotiation, at least on that, with the sponsors of the initiative.
Right.
That doesn't mean all the voters who voted for that initiative are happy. Many of them are unhappy. But they did engage in negotiations with the sponsors, the organizers of the initiative. In this case, there was none of that. They're just going in and saying, we know better.
Yeah.
The costs don't work out. We're not going to listen to your cost estimates because they're wrong. Ours are right. Therefore, we're doing what you wanted to do, but we're doing it the right way, is what they're saying. And probably we'll see them try to do this with another initiative that passed on redistricting.
Better Boundaries Initiative. Why, you talked about those vouchers, the school vouchers, and the fact that the legislature won't touch that after the proposition that was passed. Why is it a new day in dealing with propositions at the legislature? And Holly Richardson, that might be a question for you. What has, changed the sort of perspective for lawmakers on that?
I don't really know for sure, right? Because even when I was on the Hill, it was 5 years after the referendum, and it was an absolutely taboo topic. I mean, you couldn't have anything that looked like, sounded like, smelled like a voucher. They're just like, no, we just can't touch it. The public doesn't want it. We're not going to go there. So I don't know if it has to do with the current administration and people just feeling really emboldened to do whatever they want. Like, I don't know. And I'm really... it's not just a messaging thing, but the messaging is just terrible, right? And the optics are terrible. And it's like, you guys, I mean, some of them were up there when I was up there and we had HB 477, the grandma bill.
Right.
And they should remember, right? They should remember that backlash is not a good thing, that slamming stuff through is not a good thing, and to take their time and be deliberate. But
I just wonder if it points to less – is it that they recognize or – I mean, I have no data on this, but that there's less involvement from the public or more apathy and that therefore they feel empowered to do whatever they want because there might not be political repercussions.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the incumbent reelection rate. It's always very, very high, right? If they run for reelection, even on a local level, most incumbents will be reelected. It's hard to unseat an incumbent.
Yeah, in a lot of these districts, the only threat they would have is from within their own party. That's true of both Republicans and Democrats, that we have these districts that if you have the nomination of the party, that's the election is over.
Yeah.
And so that does lead to sort of a disconnect, I think, with some legislators, that they feel emboldened to feel like they don't really need to be that responsive to the voters.
Mm-hmm. Dan, we're expecting this Medicaid replacer to be voted on the House floor today, Friday, right?
That's the expectation, but with the stuff going on behind the closed doors, you never know if that's going to happen.
We're going to spend most of the hour on the legislature today, and I know a guy who says that the legislative session is just a way for the state to increase liquor sales in Utah and to get revenues from that because he feels compelled to buy more alcohol to, I guess, drown his sorrows. I just, on the alcohol front, I want to bring Bethany Rogers, Salt Lake Tribune reporter, into this conversation because you wrote just yesterday, Bethany, about the beer bill. This is the bill to allow higher percentage alcohol beer to be sold in Utah grocery stores. It's at the legislature, and it's cleared one hurdle, a first hurdle already, right?
Yeah, yesterday it cleared a Senate committee unanimously. I think that, there was a lot of surprise after pretty much all the legislators signed off on it, gave their support to it. And there was even one lawmaker who said he didn't even see it as an alcohol bill at all. He saw it as a business bill. So I think maybe that there was some interest in reframing it a little bit as less of something to just loosen the alcohol restrictions and some more of something to promote business.
This is because, this bill exists because Utah is a rarity and beer makers, or I guess at least national big beer producers, they don't want to have to make special beer just for Utah anymore. They're saying, look, we're phasing this out. Utah needs to get on board. Is that kind of the impetus behind it?
Yeah, the impetus is that they say the selection is going down in a lot of the grocery stores because of the reasons that you just mentioned. There have been some states recently that have sort of raised their own limits, sort of the way that Utah is considering right now. And as a result of that, some of these large beer producers and brewers are, as you said, deciding to sort of narrow their selection because it's just not worth it financially for them to make it anymore for such a small market.
Not everyone is on board with this idea. There were people expressing opposition in this committee meeting yesterday. Is that right? I mean, they were saying, hey, hold on a second, this has safety issues. And also small beer producers in Utah had a concern or two?
Yeah, it might be sort of a surprise to hear that some of the local breweries are actually opposed to this bill. But what they argue is that it doesn't go far enough, that their craft beer is actually even stronger than the proposed new limit. And so they say that at the level that's being proposed at this point, it would actually give an advantage to their competitors, the big guys essentially, who have an easier time just kind of making the weaker beer, I guess, stronger than what's in grocery stores now, but weaker than what the craft brewers make. So they say this would actually, you know, not help us at all. If you want to raise it even higher, then we'd be supportive of that. But at this point, we can't get on board.
That's not all local brewers. I guess there were a couple who testified in favor of it, saying that they had.
There was one. Okay. Yeah, there was one local brewer who came. Fisher's Brewing Company, I believe, which is based in here in Salt Lake City. They came in, a representative from that brewery came and said that this will allow us to do more. He also made an interesting point that it will allow craft brewers to make beer that that they suffer from a stigma that they don't make real beer, I guess, if they conform to the 3.2 limit. So he said it would be nice to be able to brew something that people consider to be actual real beer.
Real beer.
Yes.
You reported that Governor Gary Herbert was somewhat open to the idea of raising or potentially open to the idea of raising the alcohol limit in beer at grocery stores.
Yeah, he sounded kind of a similar note to some people in the committee. He said that he hadn't really looked deeply into the issue, and he kind of didn't give a firm position on it, but he said that, you know, maybe the market is changing and maybe Utah needs to respond, and that he's open to considering that.
Holly Richardson, the idea behind this bill is that the producers, the larger producers in particular, are phasing out 3.2% beer, or you know, it's not serving the market as much on that. So this, as Bethany reported, one lawmaker saying, is a commerce bill. What's your take on the move to push up the alcohol percentage in grocery stores?
Well, I just wonder if they're going to have people waiting outside the grocery stores to do breathalyzers, right, for the for the now lower limit. Look, I don't know. Utah's alcohol laws have never made sense to me, and they still don't. So I'll buy that it's a commerce issue, but there's so many other issues they could fix in the alcohol laws in Utah to not be incredibly weird.
I mean, I think they're right. It is a commerce bill, because who's really pushing for this? Retailers are, because if they lose those beer sales, they are taking a huge hit. So I can see why they're labeling it as a commerce bill, because that's where the pressure is coming from.
Speaking of losing sales, or at least losing revenue, won't the state, Bethany, doesn't it stand to lose some revenue from alcohol sales? I mean, speaking of my friend who says the legislative session is an excuse to go buy more alcohol, he might be doing that in the grocery store in the future, mm-hmm. And the state doesn't capture that revenue.
Right.
So they could lose some money.
Yeah, the bill sponsor actually raised that point and acknowledged it was a concern. I believe the fiscal note said that the state stood to lose about $4.3 million annually in revenue, because people will be going increasingly to the grocery stores to find that higher strength beer. They don't have to go to the state-run liquor stores anymore. His pushback to that was, well, you know, maybe we'll take a hit from that, but the DABC's revenues are growing anyway, and it'll just kind of sort itself out and offset it naturally.
Okay. I want to somehow find a way to work in the word brouhaha, but I'm not getting it. there are bumper stickers, there are shirts, there are all sorts of jokes referencing 3.2% alcohol in Utah, or beer in Utah. Are we going to lose some of our Utah-ness if this passes?
I'm afraid so, yeah, I think so.
Well, we will see what happens. We need to actually take a quick break on the show, and there is more to come, more fascinating news from the state legislative session just ahead here on KCBW. Behind the headlines from KCBW and the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW, and I'm joined this hour by Salt Lake Tribune Government and Politics Editor Dan Harry, reporter Bethany Rogers, and columnist Holly Richardson. You can join us with your questions and comments at 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. 8255, or you can post them at the Behind the Headlines page at sltrib.com. Dan Harry, before the break, we were talking about alcohol policy in Utah. Utah, as I think most people realize now, has a lower DUI threshold, and it's the lowest in the nation. That happened at the legislature because lawmakers said they were concerned about safety, about drunken driving in particular. For a while, here's my segue, we've been seeing studies that show that distracted driving can be just as dangerous as drunken driving. And one lawmaker has been trying to get a ban on talking on your cell phone, a handheld cell phone, that is, while you're driving. But she hasn't been able to get that passed, her version of it passed, that is. So some people have been saying, you know, this is hypocritical of lawmakers to lower the DUI threshold but not pass a bill that also would protect lives. This year, though, this bill might be making some progress. Can you tell us about this, Dan?
So the bill this year finally got out of committee, and the reason it got out of committee was because the sponsor got it assigned to a different committee than the one that has killed it in the past. The committee that it passed is the Law Enforcement Committee, and law enforcement is very strongly behind this bill. They're out there on the highways and the roads. They see the problems that distracted driving from talking on your cell phone is causing. We all see it. I mean, you know, how many times a day when you're driving do you see this going on? And, you know, if somebody pulls a bonehead move, that 9 out of 10 times you're going to pull up next to them and see that they're on their cell phone.
Right.
So, yeah, so it is making progress. I wouldn't place bets on it getting all the way through now. And the difference is, you know, in the end, lawmaking is a very personal thing. So DUI, well, it doesn't really affect lawmakers because most of them don't drink, right? But these are folks who I can almost guarantee you most of them are on their phones while they're driving. So, you know, that's a big difference there about something that affects you personally as opposed to something that doesn't.
Which is, I mean, this is already actually illegal in Utah, talking on your cell phone while driving. What this bill does is sort of clarify that you can be pulled over for it, essentially. I think that, you know, in the past, you had to be doing something else that was also illegal to be pulled over. So the opposition from lawmakers in years past has just been, this is about my personal freedom, my
Well, that's the argument that is used, that this infringes on personal freedom. What they're really saying, though, is this infringes on my freedom. This infringes on, I'm a very busy person. I need to conduct and transact business in my vehicle, and I don't want to be breaking the law when I do it.
Okay. Holly Richardson, columnist with the Salt Lake Tribune, should Utah ban talking on handheld devices while driving?
No.
Okay.
So
I can guarantee you Holly's one of those.
Holly talks on her phone while she drives. Yes, she does. So here's the thing that's interesting. Some of the studies that I've seen, and I haven't gone back really recently, but so you're talking about not holding the phone up to your ear, but there's lots of now the newer cars where it just goes through the sound system, right? And you can talk and have a conversation, but you're still distracted when you're doing that.
And
right?
It's apparently just as bad as the handheld.
But then you start to get down to, well, are you as distracted talking while you're driving, even if it's a hands-free device? Are you as distracted then as you are talking to a passenger who's in your car or looking around to the kids who is starting to throw up in the back seat, right? I mean, there are lots of things that do distract us. I do think it's wise for us not to text while we drive. But I don't think it has any chance of passing. And bless her heart, I love her. I think she's a great person. But this bill's not going to go anywhere.
Interesting. The thing about having, you know, passenger in your car and talking to them, they can also react to the road around you. Whereas, you know, the person on the phone that you're talking to and whom you're having a conversation with about whatever isn't paying attention to. Well, not that your passenger is always paying attention to the road, as you pointed out. You have kids in the back
seat,
but I mean, they might be able to at least do something. Dan Harry, Holly Richardson says this bill's not going anywhere.
She very well could be right. As I said, I think it's a big victory for Representative Moss that she got out of committee. And this may be one of those bills. Bethany and Ben Wood wrote about this before the session started. They called them boomerang bills that are popular with the public. They keep coming back. They keep coming back. And sometimes, after a number of repetitions, it kind of smooths the way And they do get through, or in some cases, they lead to initiatives.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, Holly, what about the idea of the hypocrisy there? The, you know, if talking on your phone, if distracted driving is as dangerous as drunken driving, and we're trying to protect people by lowering the DUI threshold, shouldn't we also be doing something that is equally as important in saving lives?
Yeah, I get your argument, and I just don't think the legislators are going to buy it, and I don't think many members of the public are going to buy it, because I think, to your point with the legislators, right, there are still a lot of people who don't drive after they drink, but they do talk on their cell phones. I mean, it's just ubiquitous. I mean, I drive up and down to the U almost every weekday, and almost every vehicle I pass, the driver's on their cell phone. Right. And a lot of times they're texting. So I've seen semi drivers do it. I've seen young drivers do it, you know, and I try not to text. I don't text on my phone anymore. I used to do that a lot. But I decided I didn't want that to be my obituary. And so I stopped. Yeah. But I do talk on my phone, right? So
I would say, and I'm not predicting this will pass, but I would say the one chance that it has is a lot of legislators now use hands-free.
Right.
So if this bill allows them to continue doing what they're doing, maybe it has a shot.
Okay. We'll see.
And let me just add this one thing. I think that becomes almost a privileged position, right? Because if you have enough wealth that you can buy the latest and greatest in cell phone technology and in car technology, right, that gives you an advantage over the people who are driving beater cars that don't have that kind of technology. And they may or may not have – I mean, everybody can have an earphone, you know, earphones, but still.
This is life as we know it.
I know, right? It is.
It's not fair.
It's true.
2019. well, it's cleared one hurdle, and we'll see if it gets any further in the legislature, any traction this year. All right, let's go back to reporter Bethany Rogers, and we'll stay at the legislature for this story as well. Bethany, you wrote about a freshman state lawmaker who is not necessarily an unfamiliar face in Utah politics, though. This is Phil Lyman. From San Juan County, in an interview this week with the Salt Lake Tribune, I believe, he spoke about the idea of dividing up San Juan County or creating, I guess, a new county there. This is in the wake of sort of new power dynamics in San Juan County. Can you tell us what Lyman is talking about and what the context is here, Bethany?
So San Juan County is the largest county in Utah, and Representative Lyman said the idea of dividing it has been on the table for some time. Even back in the 90s, there was a study commissioned about the feasibility of splitting up the county, and at the time they concluded it wasn't feasible. This interview came in the context of a bill that was being sponsored by Representative Kim Coleman that would kind of make it easier for new counties to form. What it would basically do is make it so that the county that wants to split off can vote on whether to split off, but the county that's left behind, the voters there don't get a say.
Okay.
So he is supportive of the bill, and Representative Coleman let me know that she wasn't sponsoring it for any particular discussion about a county divide, but that there were discussions that she was aware of going on in San Juan and in Salt Lake counties. So in talking with Representative Lyman, he said that, you know, he just wants people, if they are of a mind to divide in San Juan County, to have that ability. That's why he's supporting the bill. And he also referenced the fact that with the redistricting, the court-ordered redistricting that led to the commission changeover that you alluded to, that people in his community, which is Blanding, were feeling somewhat disenfranchised. Blanding is a population center in the county, and it was divided into three separate districts. So it had long had a hold over one of the commission seats, and it lost its control. So he said voters there are feeling somewhat disenfranchised, and he said that they shouldn't be held hostage if they want to separate.
Hollywood. I'm just going to say, sure. Welcome to the real world, honey. I'm so sorry. Too bad. So sad. Anyway,
Holly Richardson's comments there. I mean, he's essentially saying, my people aren't being represented. And
can we talk about women in the legislature? I mean, talk about being disenfranchised. Okay. Well, oh my gosh.
Or for that matter, for a long time, Navajos in San Juan County is.
I know.
This is what who hold a slim majority in terms of actual population there. I don't know. Didn't they have their own complaint about pop? You know how the San Juan County Commission was made up for decades.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean, it was three people on the commission, and for a long time, two out of the three were non-Navajo, and one of the seats was basically, as I said, controlled by a Blanding resident, and for a long time, that person was Phil Lyman himself.
Right.
So.
Right. Hey, when was the last time, just quickly for context, that Utah had a new county? Is there, was that just the formation of counties?
I believe it was 100 years ago with, 101 years ago with Daggett. And I wrote about this recently. And it's been kind of a disaster because Daggett, which is in terms of population the smallest county in the state, really has struggled the entire time for kind of a sustainable economy. There's not a population base where you can have thriving businesses there. It's remote. It's actually better access to Wyoming than it is to Utah. And so, you know, there are some people there in Daggett County. I don't think this is going to happen, but they're talking about possibly trying to reunite with Uinta County, which it split off from. I see a lot of the same thing in San Juan. If you split that in two, what is going to happen to the two halves, especially the southern half, which is where poverty, the former commissioner there that was a Navajo, Rebecca Benally, had estimated that she said poverty rate there was about 50% in the southern part of the county.
I mean, people aren't usually happy about losing the power that they historically had, which is what Holly is talking about with her comments. I don't know. This is interesting. There's another proposal that Lyman has. I don't know if you have looked into this at all, Bethany, because I don't think it was in the story, but about changing the makeup of the government of San Juan County. Really, it's for counties in general, but it would get rid of the county commission structure, as I understand it. Have you looked into this, or Dan Harry, have you guys looked into this? It's HB 257. It would turn the three-member county commission in San Juan County into a county council.
I haven't read deeply into the bill. I am aware of it. And when I was speaking with him, he alluded to the fact that other discussions are going on within San Juan County about restructuring the government. So the idea of splitting into new counties isn't the only idea on the table or that seems to have, you know, popped up in the wake of the new Navajo majority. Another idea would be to even expand the commission from three to five. So I think that there are a lot of different ideas being floated right now in sort of response to this new changeover.
Okay. Phil Lyman is now in the state legislature, and we will see what kind of legislation he gets passed and how his initiatives to think about conceivably changing the makeup of San Juan County proceed. Go ahead, Holly Richardson.
The new Mike Noel.
The new Mike Noel. He should have a T-shirt that says
Can
that.
Can I just point out, we had a story today about a commission meeting that the San Juan County Commission had earlier this week. And they're talking about a whole bunch of new resolutions, including a resolution to restore bear's ears, not only to the size that President Obama designated, but actually beyond that to what the Navajos and the tribes had originally proposed, so like 1.9 million acres. They're talking about getting out of a lot of the lawsuits that was filed by the old commission that was, you know, very conservative and kind of anti-federal government in terms of public lands. And so they're talking about reversing all of those things. And a lot of people did show up from Blanding, including the mayor, who said they are feeling disenfranchised. Like Holly said, though, you know, it's kind of
welcome to everybody else's life.
the majority rules.
Yeah.
I think you got to respect the minority, though, and I think there needs to be some attention paid to the folks who all of a sudden did lose power and feel disenfranchised. I mean, there didn't seem to be much sympathy from Holly, but I do think it's a real thing, and hopefully they'll be able to figure things out.
Well, and that sympathy would go a long ways towards preventing further division in any county if you can help. I mean, this is, I'm assuming, I don't know. But we are burning through the hour here, and we need to turn to some other stories. And so, Bethany, I want to stick with you for just a minute longer before we head to a break and talk about Utah. The state of Utah has had in its constitution a provision, an exemption to the provision that bans slavery. So there's this case in which we can have slavery in the state of Utah under the Utah Constitution. One lawmaker is trying to do something about that. Can you tell us about that, Bethany?
Yes. So Representative Sandra Hollins has proposed a constitutional amendment that would remove this slavery loophole. Basically, what the Utah Constitution says at this point is that slavery is forbidden except if someone as a punishment for a crime. So this language is not unique to Utah. It's actually, if you can believe it, patterned after language that exists in the U.S. Constitution at this point in the 13th Amendment. And it's present in other states. But there has been a move in various states to sort of get rid of this language from state constitutions, and that's what's going on here now.
And Colorado, the state of Colorado, has actually stripped this from its constitution. The process here is you pass this bill, and then it puts the question on a ballot next year so that lawmakers, so that the public can decide whether or not mm-hmm. they want to remove this reference, mm-hmm. this exemption to the ban on slavery from mm-hmm. the state constitution.
Exactly. Yeah, it has to pass by a 2/3 majority in the legislature, and then it would go onto the ballot.
Holly Richardson, will it pass by a 2/3 majority in the legislature?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a bill that's not going to have very much opposition anywhere along the way, and I think it'll pass the legislature and be on the ballot and easily pass when the public votes on it in 2020.
All right. There's some great reporting on this from Bethany at sltrip.com, including some great testimony from a variety of people. Check that out. Right now, though, we need to head to our next break in the show. There's still more to come here on Behind the Headlines from KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW. For more episodes of all our in-house podcasts, click on the Local Programs tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to KCPW to support public radio in your community.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough with KCPW Public Radio, joined this hour by the Salt Lake Tribune's Dan Harry, Bethany Rogers, and Holly Richardson. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join us by calling 801-355-TALK. That's 801-355-8255. This whole hour, essentially, we have been tackling stories from the state legislative session, and this is related. Bethany Rogers, this week you wrote about the history of women in Utah politics, specifically women in the Utah State Senate. And this all stemmed from a tweet by mm-hmm. current Utah Senator Deidre Henderson. Can you tell us what the story is, Bethany?
Yeah, it was a list produced by a local amateur historian Ron Fox of all of the Utah female senators throughout the years. So Martha Hughes Cannon was the first, and we learned this week that only 28 others have ever served in the state Senate. So I think that a couple of the female legislatures were A, celebrating that, you know, they were one of the few, and B, just kind of remarking on the fact that there hasn't been that many over such a long period of time. I think 123-year span that was covered by the list.
Excuse me. 28 total, is that correct?
29 total.
29
yeah.
total. That's interesting because this year was a big year for Utah women at the state legislature, right? We had an increase in the amount of people who are represented at the state legislature.
Yeah, it's a historic high. We reported on that. My colleague Taylor Stevens wrote a story earlier, I believe, this year on the fact that the number of women in the legislature has reached historic levels. I believe it's at 24% of the legislature now. But that's still a lower percentage than in other states throughout the nation. It lags somewhat. So even though there are more females in the legislature now than ever, it's still a fraction of the whole.
Go ahead, Holly Richardson.
I think we need to look at the party divide as well. So Democrats in the state are much, much better at electing women than Republicans are. And so when Republicans have a super, super majority and they have a tiny fraction of their body are female legislators, I think that is problematic. Mm-hmm. So right now in the legislature, in the Senate, there are two Republican female senators, and there are more men named Dan than there are Republican women, right? So there's three Republican male senators named Dan, but there's only two Republican women.
Dan Harry.
And along those lines, it's interesting to note that both in the House and the Senate, Democrat caucuses are a majority women.
They are, and their leadership reflects that.
That's been increasing over the years, very much so.
Mm-hmm. And Bethany, you threw some context into your article, the fact that when it comes to other measures on gender equity, Utah doesn't fare all that well either.
Yeah, there are a couple different studies, I guess, that came out over the past few weeks on that. Even there was a Wallet Hub study that put Utah in last place when it came to gender equity. And then there was another research study saying that Utah is the second most sexist state in the nation. And interestingly enough, that it's remarkable in that in the surveys, the amount of sexism displayed reflected by women is higher even than by men. So that plays out apparently in pay gaps, just kind of all different arenas. Hmm.
Just focusing on the number of women who hold elected office, Holly Richardson, how does that margin get shrunk? I mean, how do we elect more women to office, I guess is the question.
So that's a good question. It's an issue that I talk about and write about a lot. And some of it has to do with earlier recruitment. It does have to do with asking women to run, with encouraging them to run even if they've had a loss. It has to do with doing a lot more than just lip service. And so not every male legislator is this way, but there are some who say, we need more women in office. That's really great, but there's no action behind that. And so there has to be action. There has to be a willingness to fundraise for women, for example, because it's harder for women to raise the same amount of money than it is compared to a man. Mm-hmm. You have to have somebody who's willing to introduce women to perhaps areas of the community where they're not as likely to have an inroads. So even if they're a CEO of a tech company, for example, they're not going to know every portion, right, of their community. And so having people who are willing to introduce them and across the aisle stand up for them and say, you can vote for them. I mean, I literally have friends who say, you know, you got to watch out for your girl gang. Mm-hmm. And like, you mean the women who support each other like the good old boys club? Is that what you mean? Right. So, I mean, we really have to move past lip service to seeing more women in office and really doing some of the work of getting women elected.
And you have also written about the efforts to recruit women, trying to recruit women to actually run for those seats that are open.
Yeah. Yeah, I have. And your study that you mentioned, Bethany, with the sexism in Utah. I mean, I've talked about that. I think I've written about it, but I've at least talked about it in a speech that I did recently. And every woman who's been involved in politics knows that that's true. Right. Some of our hugest detractors are other women who say we should not be running and we should stay home.
Okay. Well, over the last 122 years, fewer than 30 women have been in the Utah State Senate. That's an interesting number. I would love to compare that against the actual number of senators who have ever, you know, been there in history.
One interesting note on that, too, is for the first 100 years, they elected 14 women senators. Mm-hmm. And then it took 22 years to double that number.
Okay.
So we are making progress. Slow.
Yeah.
Slow.
And in that first 100 years, there were 412 senators elected total. And I don't know the numbers for the last 23, but 412 in the first 100 years, and 14 of those were women.
Wow. Just in the time that we have left, Dan, here's a story from outside of the legislature, but that has an obvious connection to it. The Tribune ran a story about the first medical marijuana patient being prosecuted in Utah following the approval by voters of Proposition 2, the medical cannabis ballot initiative. That court case isn't actually setting any precedents, though, in the end, because it's not going to court. It's being settled outside of court. Can you tell us about that, Dan?
Yeah, the fellow's name was Vincent Sean Moss, and he has epilepsy. And he had a medical incident while he was driving. And when the police came and investigated, they found that he had CBD oil in his trunk. And while a lot of the CBD oil does not have the active ingredient THC in it, so it's not a problem, this was from, I believe, Oregon. And so it did have a higher concentration of THC than is legal in Utah. Although it's not an intoxicating level. So anyway, the defense and Mr. Moss praised the prosecutors because they worked with them. He worked out a plea agreement where he pleaded to a Class B misdemeanor And that will be expunged, I believe, after 6 months. And so they felt good about the outcome. Like you said, it doesn't have a precedent. This is going to be new territory for us going forward about as we have legal medical marijuana, the cases. Bethany wrote about one interesting case with a gun activist who some people say is not the most sympathetic case to be, you know, he's not a poster boy for this activity. But yeah, we're going to have a lot of these cases coming up, and it'll be interesting to see how it plays out.
And right now it's sort of, people are pointing to prosecutors in Salt Lake County who basically exhibited a certain degree of leniency toward this. If I'm not mistaken.
I believe this was in South Jordan. I think it may have been the South Jordan prosecutors. Okay.
It's interesting, and it will be interesting to follow and see where it goes. But thanks for your coverage on this, Salt Lake Tribune.
And Fox 13, our partner, I think they broke this story.
All right. Credit where credit is due, definitely. We have reached that point in the show where we need to turn to our final segment, and this is the underplayed stories of the week, stories that maybe we didn't cover today or that just need greater highlighting. And Holly Richardson, do you want to kick us off with an underplayed story of the week?
Yeah, sure. I'll go back to Senator Deidre Henderson, and she is running another food truck bill this year. It's called, Senate Bill 71. And she is, she ran this, the first bill a couple years ago because she was finding that city governments were not allowing food trucks, right? You talk about disruptive innovation and you have Uber and Lyft. And I actually sat in some of the committee hearings with taxi drivers coming in and saying, if you allow Uber to come in, people are going to die, right? And it's just weird how you always go to that. But people were really resistant to this new idea of a food truck, right? And they're going to have all these foodborne illnesses and those kinds of things. And so she ran this bill and she said, okay, food trucks can exist. But what she has found is that there are still municipalities and other locations around the state that say, basically, we don't have to follow state law. And we're going to add additional requirements to the food trucks in our area. We're going to make it harder for them. We're not going to let them locate in front of, you know, X number of feet in front of a restaurant, whatever. And so she is running this bill. It passed without any opposition yesterday out of committee.
Part of this is also to allow, if you get essentially licensed in one county or one
that's
municipality,
right.
you can still travel across jurisdictions.
Yeah, that's right. And so what she's saying, what the bill clarifies, which should have been clear but now needs legislation to clarify, is that you cannot make a municipal law or rule that trumps state law. And that's one of them, right? So if you have a license one place, it is applicable anywhere you travel.
All right. Well, maybe some good news for food trucks. We will see what happens. Bethany Rogers, do you have a pick for underplayed story of the week?
I do. My underplayed story comes from my colleague Lee Davidson, who wrote about a bill sponsored by Representative Ken Ivory that would allow cars to go through red lights after, I guess, looking both ways in very low traffic situations. But I draw attention to this story. It's a good read because it contains some of the most transportation puns you'll ever see.
It's very pun heavy. But it's so that bill didn't advance, right?
It did not. It was held in committee for further work.
Okay. If I'm not mistaken, and just quickly, there's a bill that's similar, not for cars but for bicycles, and that would allow bicycles to basically yield at to stop at red lights and then proceed through, or to yield at stop signs. Either of you followed that bill lately to see if it's advanced further? We'll take a look.
It's passed out of committee.
So.
And whether or not it's at a House or a floor hearing, we don't know yet. Dan Harry, we'll turn to you now for your pick for underplayed story of the week.
I will pick Energy Solutions is on the move once again in the legislature. Last year, they got a $1.7 million fee break. This year, they're trying to open the door for new expanded types and possibly hotter radioactive waste.
This is B and C type nuclear waste that could be allowed essentially because of depleted uranium becoming hotter over time.
Exactly. And Energy Solutions is one of the top donors to legislators. And last year we looked at this very strong correlation between those who receive money from the company and those who vote for bills designed to help it.
There was some really interesting committee audio on this, or some hearing, some testimony on this in which Members of the Utah Department of Environmental Quality came and said, "This, you know, right now we have a blanket ban on B and C waste, and if this passes, basically it's going to be on a case-by-case, site-specific decision-making process from somebody within
from,
DEQ.
From regulators, yeah, regulators. Rather than policymakers. Mm-hmm. If you remember John Huntsman, when he was governor, and Gary Herbert, when he was lieutenant governor, made this one of their cornerstone issues. They were not going to allow hotter waste to come into the state. And Gary Herbert is now the governor, still does not accept donations from Energy Solutions. It'll be interesting to see how this one plays out.
Especially if it makes it to his desk.
Yep.
Okay. For my part, for Underplayed Story, I'm going to go with a story that I covered yesterday, a bill to extend the ban on heavy trucks on Legacy Parkway failed in committee. As it stands, the ban on heavy trucks on Legacy, which is a slower, quieter, you know, marshland-adjacent road, that truck ban ends on January 1st of next year. There's another bill that's going to be in the House to extend the ban by 5 years, and we will see if it goes anywhere. But what happened to the Senate bill might not be a good sign for it. Dan Harry, Bethany Rogers, and Holly Richardson, all with the Salt Lake Tribune, thanks very much for joining me this morning.
Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
You as well. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of KCPW and the Salt Lake Tribune. Thanks very much to Jesse Ellis here at KCPW and to the team at our partners at Utah Public Radio in Logan. Thanks very much to everyone up at UPR. Find podcasts of this and all of our local programs at kcpw.org or through your podcast app. I'm Roger McDonough. Thanks again for joining us. We'll see you once again next week.